I'm Dave DeWitt. This is Tested from WUNC, a look at what the day's challenges tell us about where we are, what we believe, and who we want to be in North Carolina and the South. Today, maybe the waste will save us. North Carolina just topped 2 million tests in the state, revealing more than 130,000 COVID cases. Tested isn't just the name of this podcast. It's also a limitation, as the pandemic has spread far beyond our capacity to test.
When we test people, we're testing individuals, but now we're getting a metric of the entire system, and we know who's contributing to certain wastewater systems.
Dr. Rachel Noble is a professor of marine sciences at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Her team is collecting wastewater from numerous towns and cities in the state. Because in addition to whatever is coming out of our sinks, showers, and toilets, that sewage is also now likely to include the coronavirus.
One of the largest differences between this and the individual testing is that you're now capturing a metric of the entire population, regardless of access to medical care, knowing who to go to for a test, where in the process of being infected they might be, early, middle, late. It's going to pick up those mildly ill or asymptomatic individuals that the testing system currently is not.
Noble's research is also giving a more detailed look at where COVID hotspots are forming. DHHS breaks down cases by county and zip code. Noble's team is taking that a step further and focusing on local sewage systems.
So in Charlotte, we know the households that are contributing to that system. Even in a small town, like in a municipality, we know the people that are contributing to that system. And so we can understand a bit more about the whole community. And we know that this virus, and similar to other viruses, that it makes its way through your gut and it makes its way out in the waste that people excrete. That's similar to a lot of different viruses that we work on. As a matter of fact, this approach was used back in the 1940s and 1950s as a way to try to control major outbreaks of polio. So the concept of using wastewater as a metric for an entire population and to know what to do about that population is definitely not new. But the technology that we're using is new. So now we can use really advanced sensitive technology to get down at the right limits of detection and so forth.
What's sort of a scenario that someone could take this data, a decision maker, a mayor, a city council, and what could they do with it? What could be a scenario where you would find some data that you think would be concerning or somehow highlighting something that maybe you didn't know about what the community is experiencing in relation to the virus? How can this help, essentially?
So the very first example of that is in a small town, or maybe even in a larger town. If you go from a trend of seeing zero in your wastewater and zero over time, as we have for the earlier weeks of the pandemic and some of our smaller systems, and then now all of a sudden you see that the virus is being detected, you know that you have enough virus in the system for it to reflect some level of community prevalence, which at first in this whole long process that we've all been through, we all kind of thought that a lot of the infections were being brought into towns and cities from overseas. And then people started to hear this version of a term called community prevalence, which meant that it was being exchanged in our own grocery stores, hardware stores, and so forth. And so once you begin to see it, whether it goes from zero to 1,000 or zero to only 200 viruses in that wastewater sample, you know that you have emergence of the virus in your town. The second that you can do is if you are careful to do the sampling over a window of time, let's say you do it daily over a 2-week period. And if you had done that over the course of July 4th, you would be able to see how singular events of maybe a holiday or some other kind of effect, like maybe coming up here, students going back to school, you would be able to see the impact of that start And what evolves over time, over about a week to 2 weeks from that point, you would be able to see whether that caused a strong uptick in the concentrations in the wastewater, thereby reflecting that you have an increased number of people in the community that are infected that need to be, you know, using caution.
Do you envision these methods eventually going to, I think I saw where almost 60% of North Carolinians are on septic systems, are not on sewage systems. Is this something that could be expanded? And that seems like a huge step.
It is a huge step. And the reason why it's a huge step is my laboratory has done septic system research before, and it is time consuming. Imagine you have a neighborhood as the one I live in that has about 60 or 70 homes. And now you're faced with, before you can do anything else, you've got to go out and take a representative sample from any of a number of those homes, bring it back to the lab, and then start your process. Just the process of interacting with people and figuring out, you know, access to the septic system and so forth. None of that is, you know, incredibly easy. Some people welcome you to come sample their septic system, and some people just simply can't get the lid off of their distribution box. These are all things to think about, but you could think about there being some way in the future for future capacity building where you'd have some sort of a, almost like a port on a septic system where you could actually walk up and you could collect a sample easily and you could use that as a composite metric of what's going on in a neighborhood.
So much of this you can see, you know, utilizing in the future. Hopefully someday this pandemic will end. But this seems like methods and systems that you're developing now could play a real role in public health moving forward. I mean, are there ways in which you see maybe beyond the pandemic in which these things that you're developing could serve a real purpose?
Yes, absolutely. So there's multiple ways. Before this all came about, we already were working on what people refer to as gastrointestinal pathogens like norovirus or adenovirus. And we were already working on wastewater systems. So if you're building this kind of capacity to be able to track viruses really nicely and quantitatively in wastewater, it's not too far-fetched that you would be able to use the same kinds of methods over time to tell you things about a whole wide range of pathogens, not just coronaviruses. And you would have basically inline ongoing monitoring. And once something kind of emerged, you would be able to let the town know about it. You would be able to be more proactive is what we've really tried to stress rather than reacting to the infections, which is how the clinical system works. And the second way that this can actually be used is that over time, we can actually use this approach to tell us something about the trends of how people are interacting. We can see if there are certain kinds of activities or events or social interactions that really cause some of these outbreaks, even for the flu. So it really makes sense. I will really want to stress that at the end of this process, our goal is to be able to have a simplified, cost-effective method that we can hand over to the wastewater treatment plants and in some capacity to the state. It is not our desire to be continuing to do the research on this. We'll move on to the next virus. We're fine with that. We want to build the capacity where they can build this ability to read the sewage and tell basically the community what this story that's being told by the wastewater.
Dr. Rachel Noble is a professor of marine sciences at UNC Chapel Hill. Hang tight, more in a moment.
I'm Anita Rao, a host at WUNC. A lot of my job is asking difficult questions and digging deeper for the answers, even when it gets uncomfortable. It's the trust and understanding that's built when a conversation gets into awkward territory that drives my new podcast, Embodied. It's impolite conversations, intimate connections, and important discoveries in every episode. Listen and subscribe today on your favorite audio app.
Like so many white guys my age, I can pull out a Seinfeld reference for any occasion. And right now, this one fits my ongoing mood.
I'm on no sleep. No sleep. You don't know what it's like in there. All night long, things are creaking and cracking, and that red light is burning my brain.
You look a little stressed.
Oh, I'm stressed.
Oh, I'm stressed too. We all are, on some level. But how much, and how are we handling it? Researchers at North Carolina State University and Georgia Tech asked people in every state how they were dealing with stress between late March and mid-April. Siobhan Newpert is a professor of psychology at NC State.
We realized that the stress that people are experiencing around this pandemic is a new kind of stress. The fact that things were closing and people had to start taking precautions, and we didn't know much about the disease itself. There was a lot of unknowns. We felt like it would be important to understand how people were experiencing stress and what might predict the stress that they were experiencing, this new stress around the pandemic.
Newpert says the more knowledge people had about COVID-19, the less stressed they were. But she notes that knowledge and information are not necessarily the same.
So we tried to distinguish very carefully between someone's actual knowledge about the facts surrounding COVID-19. And we don't necessarily know how they acquired that knowledge, but because we had this objective, basically it was a quiz, a knowledge quiz about if they could identify the symptoms and the likelihood of transmission or the ways in which transmission can happen. And if they were getting inaccurate information and they believed that what they were getting was accurate, then that would have shown up in their knowledge score. They would have scored lower than someone who was engaging with more factual information.
Going into the study, Newpert thought older adults would overall be more stressed because of greater health risks. But they found that older and younger people generally experienced the same levels of stress.
But the ways in which those age differences manifested, we saw in the way they were coping with the stress. So older people were able to use proactive coping. They were able to see stress in the future and try to take steps to reduce it. And so that ability to make plans and try to avoid adverse events for older adults really helped them reduce their pandemic-related stress.
Newpert says the next step is to look more closely at that knowledge component and research where people get their information on COVID-19. That's it for this episode of Tested. I'm Dave DeWitt. Charlie Shulton-Ormond is our producer. Lindsay Foster-Thomas is the executive producer. Thanks for listening.